The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So my name is Andrea, for those of you who I've not met before. And tonight, actually for the next 3 weeks, I thought of exploring the theme of reactivity, how we react to events, experiences, and ways that our mindfulness practice and our meditation practice can support first an understanding of that reactivity, and then support a learning in how to navigate that reactivity so that it's less stressful for us, less struggle. So this week I mostly want to talk about kind of understanding what reactivity is, how it works in our minds. Actually, the Buddha was an amazing almost like a mental surgeon. He was so precise in understanding how our minds got caught into difficulty. And so I'd like to explore some of that with you, because the understanding itself, I think, begins to help us, to support us. So to start with, what do we think of when we think of reactivity and suffering in our lives? We often might think of physical pain in our bodies. Our bodies are, prone to having accidents and being cut and bruised and all kinds of illness. We get sick. We suffer when we get sick. So there's the physical aspect of our experience that we react to. And then there's stuff that happens in our minds that we react to, or mental experiences that we react to. We get lonely or confused or angry or frustrated about, sometimes about physical things, but also sometimes about ideas. Thinking about ways that you get frustrated about things or confused about things. Is it always about what's happening in your body, or is sometimes it about something you're thinking about? I need to do this thing, and I don't have time to do this thing, and it's overwhelming to think about all the things I have to do in order to get that done, and whew, it's like we collapse. So we suffer, we struggle, we react both to the side of our physical body and to stuff happening in our minds. So we often think that the suffering or the struggle or the problem, let's call it the problem, we often think the problem, the reason why we're struggling and we're suffering, has something to do either with the physical pain itself or with the experience. It's the event or the circumstance that is the problem. It's the pain that is the problem. And that's the question, actually, the Buddha looked at in his exploration. He started his search for happiness by asking the question, how do we suffer, and is it possible that we might find a way to freedom from that suffering? And so he began looking at how we suffer. He began investigating all of these different ways that I've just talked about, the ways that we feel things are off. Other ways we feel things are off is when we kind of feel disconnected or bored or confused. It's like we're not quite in sync with what's going on. So the question that we could ask is it possible, or could we be at ease when there is pain in the body? Could we be at ease when there are circumstances that don't seem the way we'd like them to be? Can we find ease in our lives? So the proposal is that the Buddha offered is that the experience of suffering, the experience of the mind reacting to things, isn't inherently connected to the circumstances in the world or the circumstances of our body. That there's a kind of a process that unfolds that we react to these circumstances. And his proposal is actually interesting. He says that it's the reaction itself, it's reactivity that is where the suffering is. If we didn't react, if we didn't have the sense of really not liking things that were unpleasant, not feeling overwhelmed by situations, if the overwhelm didn't exist, if the reactivity didn't exist, we wouldn't have the feeling that there was a problem. We wouldn't have the feeling of there being a lack of ease, perhaps I should say. Because we can have a sense that there's a problem or something that needs to be changed in the world. This is an important point, actually, that this exploration around reactivity doesn't mean that we simply say, well, everything that happens is okay. It's all in my mind that I'm struggling or suffering. That's not exactly what the teaching is suggesting. It does say that the suffering that we experience, that the pain, the reactivity, is under our own. I don't know. I don't quite use the word control, but that there are things in our own hearts and minds that we can do to kind of decouple us from the reactivity that we have around events and situations. But that doesn't mean, because there's that kind of decoupling of the reactivity, it doesn't mean that we simply say, oh yes, everything is perfect the way it is. You know, there are injustices in the world that we can engage with trying to change without hating it. Without hating the situation, without hating the people, without bringing anger and frustration to the situation. But, you know, it's actually, we change the situation. The exploration becomes, can we change the situation? Can we make action not out of hatred, greed, desire, confusion, but out of wisdom, out of compassion, out of kindness instead. So this is kind of the proposal that the Buddha makes, that it's possible for us to turn our hearts to release that gripping of anger, confusion, wanting, desire, that sense of needing to hold on when something feels good, the sense of, you know, oh, it feels right now. This is another way that we suffer, that, you know, we get something that we like, and then perhaps we have a sense of happiness around it for a little while. You know, I just got a new car, so there's some happiness going on around the new car. There's also a little bit of agitation going on around the new car. You know, checking, is that black spot a dent? You know, so there's a little bit of agitation going on. So, you know, there's the experience of having something that's pleasant and we hold to it. It's like there's a fear that it will go away, a fear that it'll be damaged or destroyed or ruined. And so we suffer even when we have something pleasant. because we are holding to it. We're not wanting it to change. So the Buddha, in his exploration around this question of dukkha, began looking at, well, is physical pain itself dukkha? And his, you know, like the body, you know, the body is designed to produce pain. You know, that one of the things that is not going to go away, no matter how much we meditate, no matter how calm our minds get, no matter how easeful things get, if we break our leg, there will be physical pain. So, you know, the meditation isn't going to change that. But the meditation and the mindfulness practice and this exploration around reactivity will have the capacity to help us be more peaceful when something like breaking our leg happens. More with a sense of taking action to, it's not that you just sit there with a broken leg and say, oh, a broken leg, look at that, a broken leg. Meditation means being easeful with things as they are, so just sit here with this broken leg. That's not wise. You know, you need to get yourself to the doctor, you need to get your leg set, you know, taking the action, but without all the additional reactivity around, oh my God, what does this mean? And how hard is it going to be? I mean, we project into the future when something challenging happens for us. This is something I see in my own mind, that when there's something challenging going on, often what the mind, one thing that the mind can do with that is it projects into the future and it's trying to plan out all the things that it has to do and figure out, and how am I going to do this, and how am I going to drive my car if I've got a broken leg, and how am I going to make breakfast, and how am I going to even get up and down the stairs in my house. And we take all of this on in our thoughts and we wilt. It's like, oh, this is so difficult. That part is optional. And that's the part that we can really begin to make some headway with our practice, with our mindfulness practice. So the physical pain itself is not what the Buddha meant by suffering. He really meant this kind of reactivity, that when something difficult happens, painful experience, painful situation happens, we don't like it. We don't want it. We want to fix it and change it. We want to hold on to things when they're the way we like them, rather than kind of understanding that there's a flow of changing situation. So the kind of demand for a result, that it's got to be this way, it's not okay if things are not that way, that's a lot of where our struggle and our suffering comes in. So just imagine the possibility of being non-reactive if you had a broken leg. Non-reactive to all of the proliferation of thoughts around it. If there was just the pain of the broken leg, you know, it would be much easier to take care of it. Much easier to navigate your world if you weren't taking on the extra burden of all of the reactivity around that physical pain. The Buddha talked about how when we experience physical pain, the typical reaction to that is like there's the physical pain, which is, you know, that's just what it is. And then he said it's as if we've been struck by a dart, stuck by an arrow with that physical pain. And then he said, and then we pick up another dart and strike ourselves with the reactivity to it. I hate this. I don't like, you know, I want to get rid of this. We get angry at the situation, you know. We either get angry at ourselves or angry at something, somebody, you know, we can get angry at a sidewalk. You know, we tripped and fell and broke our leg on the sidewalk. We can get angry at the sidewalk. We can get angry at the city for having not fixed the sidewalk. We can get so overloaded with reactivity Each one of those is like stabbing ourselves with another dart. Because that reactivity itself, that anger itself, creates ripples of tension, stress, mental holding, tightening in our minds. So it compounds the situation to have that mental reactivity. So just imagine the possibility of not mentally reacting to physical pain. It seems kind of far-fetched, but it is possible. It is possible. And likewise, imagine being non-reactive to situations like, you know, somebody cutting you off on the freeway. You know, that's an event. It happens. You know, there's not necessarily any physical pain that happened from that situation. But there may be the fear of the person cutting you so close. The anger that comes up about somebody driving in that way. Those are mental reactions to the event. And again, might it be possible? Can you envision the possibility of how it might be to not be reactive to that event, but rather responsive? Responsive might mean put on the brake, slow down, something like that, rather than screaming and yelling. So the possibility, again, of not adding that, the second, the third, the fourth arrows to the situation, perhaps inclining more towards an open-hearted response to the situation. As we imagine events getting more and more strong, you know, imagining losing a job or losing a partner to illness, we begin to see that it's harder and harder to imagine what it might mean to be non-reactive to those kinds of situations. What might it mean to be non-reactive to a partner dying? It doesn't mean, you know, that kind of exploration makes us kind of see that we can be attached to our reactivity in a way. You know, in a way we think partly it's what makes us human. You know, who would I be if I didn't react to my partner dying? You know, I wouldn't be human if I didn't react to that. So there's, again, thinking of the word of responsive rather than reactive, and thinking of what it might mean to have an open-hearted response to difficult situations, rather than a closed-hearted response to difficult situations. That's part of the terrain of reactivity. In the terrain of reactivity, the heart feels closed. It feels like there's not many options. It often has a sense of things having to be in one way, or in order to fix the problem, it has to be the way I want to fix it. The open-hearted responsiveness sees more possibility, has a response from the perspective of kindness and compassion. The response to losing a partner might be deep sadness, but a sadness that isn't sticky. It really acknowledges and opens to the truth that it's like this. It's like this. It doesn't, you know, that kind of, it's not to say we're going to go through life feeling indifferent if we're not reactive. In fact, in my own experience, the more my heart becomes less contracted, the less contracted my heart becomes, the more open my heart becomes, the more deeply I feel the pain of the world. It reverberates in the heart, that pain in the world. And it calls up this wish to alleviate that pain, but not from a perspective of hatred, more from that perspective of compassion. Compassion being the open-hearted response to suffering. So the roots of reactivity kind of got different layers to it, starting from kind of the outer side, the outer layer of what we experience as reactivity. We experience a lot of difficult emotions. The roots of these difficulties that the Buddha pointed to are greed, aversion, and delusion. And these lead to many reactive emotions: anger, hatred, rage, frustration, irritation, hostility, pride, conceit, wanting, lust, avarice, confusion, boredom. Many, many states that we find ourselves in where things feel off. Things feel like it's not the way we'd like it to be. When things don't feel the way we'd like it to be, the Buddha suggests this is worth understanding. This was his way in to exploring this question of suffering. He started looking at, can I understand this? Can I understand what this suffering is about? Underneath that, those layers of reactivity, is often a subtler layer. And actually, next week I'll talk more about how to work more directly with those difficult emotions, turning towards them in our practice, having the courage to meet those experiences. What I'd like to do this week is more get into the structure of how this reactivity comes into being in the first place. And so underneath those outermost layers, or the kind of more obvious forms of reactivity, are subtler levels of reactivity that often those larger forms of reactivity have grown out of. Very simple, liking and not liking. When we like something, we tend to want it. We tend to start to congeal about it and want to hold on to it and figure out how to keep it and hold it and identify it as mine. When we don't like something, we want to figure out how to get rid of it. If we can't get rid of it, there can be an escalation. If something happens and we don't like it and we manage to get rid of it, it kind of drops out of our mind. But if something happens, this was an area that the exploration of anger was an area that I spent a lot of time looking at, particularly in the first years of my practice. And, I began to understand through looking at my anger that there was the kind of underneath it was the fact that I didn't like, in one particular situation, I didn't like the fact that my boyfriend had broken up with me. And I played that scenario over and over in my mind, and the very playing of it over and over in my mind escalated it. And I began to understand that the replay was turning the not liking of the situation into the difficult experience of anger. So underneath our greater forms of reactivity, often there is just this very simple liking, not liking, almost in a, kind of primitive way. Our brains have that aspect of liking things that are pleasant, not liking things that are not pleasant. It's close to being biological. It's definitely natural. You know, if you think about the evolution of our nervous system, we can start by thinking about a single-celled creature. And, you know, in a very simple way, it goes towards the food and it goes away from a noxious environment, kind of hardwired in that system of the single-celled creature. The survival of that single-celled creature depends on that hardwired activity. The more the nervous system evolved, in my understanding, is the more the nervous system evolved, the more essentially removed, in a way, the response got from that very automatic kind of hardwired response. And in our nervous system, I read an interesting book about this. Some of you might be interested in this kind of thing, so I'll give you the reference. It's called Self Comes to Mind, and it's an evolutionary look at how the sense of self is kind of part and parcel of the way our nervous system evolved. And that it is, you know, as the Buddha said, the sense of self is a construct. This research in the neurology points to it being a construct partly of the way the brain works. The book called Self Comes to Mind by Antonio Damasio. And one of the interesting things I found about that exploration of our nervous system is that with the kind of complicated nature of our minds and bodies, essentially, you know, our nervous system is designed to protect the system, to protect the organism. The nervous system is designed to protect the organism, much as that simple mechanism of you know, hardwired reactivity or moving towards pleasant away from unpleasant in that single-celled creature is designed to protect that creature. So our nervous system is designed to protect the organism, and the way the nervous system has evolved, essentially there's a map in our minds, and they can even see how it's laid out in our brain. There's a map of our organism in our minds, in our brain, and the nervous system, rather than being designed actually to protect the organism, the physical being directly, the nervous system is designed to protect the map in the brain. And so it's actually faster, apparently. You know, so it's apparently, you know, it serves us well, because there's a long distance between, you know, the edges of the body and the brain, you know, so protecting the map is apparently like a little shortcut, so it makes it more efficient. So that protection of the map, while it's quite sophisticated, it is not hardwired the way that amoeba-like reactivity is hardwired. So when we experience pleasant things, there's a kind of a natural movement towards liking them and wanting more of them, because our organism has this kind of basic program that says increase pleasure, decrease displeasure. We've got this kind of basic program going like that, increase pleasure, decrease unpleasure. And so we tend to move towards things that are pleasant. So it's very natural that that happens. And yet much of the way we tend to move towards things that are pleasant and move away from things that are unpleasant involves a fair amount of delusion. Because our minds are kind of short-sighted about pleasant and unpleasant when we're not aware of the full impact of kind of the larger experience. And so, for instance, so we've got this pleasant happening, this pleasant experience happening, and this movement towards liking and wanting to have it, that movement from pleasant to liking to wanting. On the surface of it, it sounds like, well, that's leading the organism towards well-being. But when we actually bring our mindfulness to this process of something being pleasant and liking it and wanting it, we actually see that the wanting itself doesn't feel good. The wanting itself, when something is pleasant, when we want it, the wanting itself already creates a feeling of something's wrong, something's off. When we get that thing, that feeling of things being off goes away. And so partly we believe, because we haven't been seeing very clearly, that the wanting itself springing up is when that feeling of offness originated. So the pleasant happened, and there's the movement towards it. We've learned, you know, over and over again, we get something, we like it, it feels good. We get something pleasant, we get it, we like it, it feels good. And so we kind of go for that movement towards having the pleasant things. But we haven't actually noticed the very offness that springs up as soon as that wanting comes up. There's a form of delusion in the wanting itself that says, for happiness to follow, you have to get this thing. Wanting, that state of mind of wanting something, is not going to tell you, oh, by the way, if the wanting goes away, there's not going to be a problem. That state of wanting inherently wants to get the thing that it wants. But if we explore with mindfulness, we explore both, you know, the state of wanting itself, we explore that, we see that it is the wanting that feels off. And that if the wanting goes away, there's no problem. We don't have to get the thing in order to feel okay. Likewise with aversion. We don't have to push the thing away in order to feel okay. Now again, there are things, I mean, this again, people may feel like it. I'm saying, well, if something unpleasant happens, just sit there and watch it and don't do anything. But it's the energy of aversion and wanting that we can start to explore. We don't have to, in taking action doesn't have to be motivated out of that wanting or pushing away. It can be motivated out of compassion, out of kindness, out of generosity, out of wisdom. So the pleasant and unpleasant aspect of experience, it's not hardwired that we would go from pleasant to liking, to wanting, to needing, to holding, to fear that it's going to go away. It's not hardwired. There is the possibility of actually kind of breaking into that process and seeing that there are little gaps between each of those movements. The pleasant arises, and there's just a little gap before that kind of leaning into liking happens. And there's just a little gap before that reaching out to say, oh, let me have that, happens. And in those gaps, what we begin to experience is that when we can see, oh, there's pleasant arising, oh, pleasant is happening, and the wanting doesn't happen, or the wanting is released, there is the recognition by the nervous system, by the organism, essentially, that release of the wanting is actually a deeper form of well-being than having what we want. And so this process of observing our reactivity begins to educate the mind in another way towards happiness, one that's based more on open-heartedness than the contraction of the way we normally go about our lives. It's so wonderful, actually, that there are these little gaps, because it means there is the possibility of kind of turning the battleship, turning the huge ship around. You know, it's not there's a lot of momentum behind our habits of reactivity, a lot of momentum. It is like it's a steamship going in that direction. It's a huge amount of force and energy headed in the direction towards our habitual ways of reacting to things. But it is not hardwired, and it is possible to begin to turn the mind in another direction. And one of the ways to explore this is through beginning to get interested in this movement from pleasant to liking to wanting, from unpleasant to liking, not liking to not wanting, to begin to recognize that most of our difficulties have to do with this kind of very well-greased path of the mind to react in this way. So we can begin to explore when we are reacting. Like, for instance, one of my teachers said, if there's aversion happening in your experience of any form, there's so many different forms of aversion. I mentioned a few of them: anger, hatred, frustration, irritation. So if any of those are happening, and there's way more, if any of those are happening, there's something unpleasant going on. Can you recognize what the unpleasantness is? What are you actually reacting to? Because it can be surprising sometimes when we begin to see, oh, there's reaction happening. What am I actually reacting to? So a simple example of this was kind of surprising for me. I was doing this exploration around noticing when I was reacting and seeing where's the unpleasantness going on, because much of my reactivity came around the aversive side of things. So I began exploring my aversive states and then looking, what's actually unpleasant here? What's actually going on? I was doing walking meditation on a retreat, and I experienced a lot of aversion during the walking meditation about all the people who were walking nearby. And I began to explore, and one time I was kind of happily walking back and forth in the room, and, you know, the people were kind of spaced out. And then, there was a lot of space between people. Not that the people were spacing out. There was a lot of space between the people. And somebody else came in and started walking right up next to me. Oh, there was all this aversion that came up. And I began exploring, well, what is this about? You know, where's the unpleasant here? What is unpleasant in this experience? And, you know, it kind of seemed obvious, of course, that the unpleasant was somehow in that person. That's what the mind was telling me. The unpleasant is in that person. That person is doing something that's unpleasant. And so I began exploring, you know, well, seeing. Is it the seeing that's unpleasant? And I had to acknowledge that, no, the seeing wasn't particularly unpleasant. There was a little kind of funny way the person walked a little bit. That was a little amusing, but it wasn't unpleasant. There wasn't any unpleasant smell. There wasn't any physical contact from the person. I wasn't tasting anything unpleasant. And it was pretty quiet, so I wasn't hearing anything unpleasant. So I had eliminated the five physical senses there wasn't unpleasant experience in the five physical senses. And it's like, okay, there must be something going on in my mind that's unpleasant. And it was not obvious to me what was going on in my mind. So I kind of just kept walking, being curious about unpleasantness. And at some point, I heard the thought in my mind, he's weird. My mind, and it was kind of like, well, there's a thought. It didn't quite click, you know, that was what it was. You know, that's what was unpleasant. But in the next moment, there was another thought that, I mean, it was the middle of winter, and this person was in bare feet, and my mind erupted with this, you know, he's in bare feet, and it's freezing cold outside. And that was my justification for, he's weird. I saw how ludicrous that was, and at that point, I recognized that the entire reactivity and aversion had been built out of a reaction to a thought in my mind. And that was kind of mind-blowing, to see just, it was all completely constructed in my own mind. So that kind of exploration, what are we actually reacting to? What does it come back to? It almost always comes back to either something pleasant or unpleasant in our experience. Sometimes it comes back to something neutral, but often it's something pleasant or unpleasant in our experience. Another example of this, one night I was meditating late at night, and it was, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning or something. I was in my house. I was having trouble sleeping, so I got up to meditate, which is one of the ways that I work with insomnia. And so I was meditating, and there was this tapping sound that started going. And my initial response was that I felt that the tapping sound was unpleasant. So I recognized, I acknowledged that the tapping was unpleasant. So there was that piece of it. The tapping was unpleasant. And I kept observing, kept noticing. And as I noticed this experience, I noticed that whenever the tapping sound began, I felt a contraction in my body. And that was also unpleasant, that contraction in the body. The tapping seemed just mildly unpleasant. It was a kind of a quiet tapping sound. The contraction was more unpleasant. And then as I kept watching, at some point I recognized that there was fear that hadn't been actually clearly seen either. The fear was definitely unpleasant, the fear that came with that tapping. And as the mind became cognizant of the fear that was present, the whole experience shifted in that the tapping itself was no longer unpleasant. And this was an interesting exploration of how our mind states can influence what we take to be pleasant and unpleasant. There was a you know, a little bit of sound, and I think what my mind was doing is something like, there's a rat somewhere, you know, it was creating some scenario of something to be afraid of. And it was reacting to the fear. All of this had really kind of happened at a very quiet level in the mind. It was not very conscious. But the willingness to be mindful and to look, okay, there's something happening. There's the unpleasant experience. Let's look at that. Let's observe that and see what we get to see. It really taught me a huge amount. And the actually in seeing how, again, you know, it was just the tapping. It was just this little tapping, and seeing how the fear, again, was a construct in the mind. So the structure of reactivity in our minds is really built out of this very, it can be kind of subconscious almost, subconscious response to pleasant and unpleasant experience. And often we're not very aware of what's pleasant and unpleasant in our experience because we're living in the world of our usual habitual responses. If we can begin to get interested in what are we reacting to? What is unpleasant here? What is pleasant here? It can begin to kind of lower that horizon of the subconscious. That's my experience with the mindfulness practice. The more I pay attention to what's going on, the more I can see about how the mind is putting these reactions together. And that very seeing of that helps the mind to navigate its way towards well-being without the contraction. It's almost something we can't figure out how to do consciously. But our willingness to observe our processes of body and mind begin to help the system, the organism, find its way to a well-being beyond this reactivity, beyond this contractedness. And in that terrain, we do have more of the open heart, responding to the world rather than reacting to the world, meeting the world with compassion, with friendliness, with caring, with love, with generosity. So I want to leave some time for discussion, thoughts, questions, anything that you'd like to bring up. Yeah.
The progression from pleasant feeling to liking to wanting, that, I guess, in turn then brings a sort of suffering, which in nature is how we end up, a carrot becomes a stick.
Yes, exactly.
And so then we are motivated to get the carrot because we're lacking it. And yeah.
That's exactly, yes.
And my question is, what about compassion, which my understanding it differs from empathy in that you really have the desire or the wish to alleviate some problem of somebody else's.
Right.
And in a sense, that is also, it seems to me, a stick. Is there a qualitative difference?
There is a difference. And the difference partly has to do with the construction that goes on in our mind that says, for instance, in this case, I have to have the carrot. So it's the wanting and the aversion create a demand for a particular outcome. Whereas compassion is much more responsive to possibility. We do not, our happiness, our well-being is not reliant on a particular outcome. That motivation, that wish to alleviate the suffering is there. We may take action to alleviate the suffering. We may feel the resonance of even deeper suffering if there's no possibility of creating well-being for the situation. And yet our own sense of well-being that includes that compassion isn't compromised. So it really does. The mind of reactivity is the mind of rigid results, needing, seeing certain ways and needing to have certain results. The mind of compassion is more open to possibility of, and also able to meet that suffering when there isn't a possibility to change. That's another key piece around compassion. The compassion does have the wish to alleviate the suffering, but it doesn't close down if it's not possible. So sitting with a dying friend recently, You know, my heart felt very open to that. If I could have said something or done something to change it, yes, I would have, you know. But that wasn't possible. And so the heart with compassion doesn't close down in the face of suffering. The heart of reactivity often closes down in the face of not getting what it wants or not getting rid of what it doesn't want. Does that speak to you?
You know, it sounds like a lot of it has to do with, do you identify with the result, and
yes.
Does it hurt if you don't get the result? Whereas in compassion, that identification is somehow released.
Yes, yes. It's a process of exploration, how we can find our way there. And, you know, the willingness to sit in that place, the willingness to sit with somebody's suffering, you know, that is such a huge gift, to be able to do that, and not many people seem to be able to stay in an open heart in the face of suffering. And it's a gift for the world to be able to do that too. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
You know, when I'm listening to you speak, and I realize I've heard a lot of this teaching before, what comes to my mind is, I think there is a potential danger that people may hear in the message that it's not okay to have a reaction. And therefore, they will beat themselves up about having a reaction. They will judge themselves about having a reaction. And what I choose for myself is to love my reaction, and to just honor it for what it is. And I invite other people to do the same, because if I don't do that, then I will be creating another reaction on top
absolutely.
Of the first,
yes.
Which makes it even worse.
Yes, absolutely.
And I also believe that it's important for me to try to do my best to love your reaction when you're reacting to whatever it is I'm doing.
Yes, and that's actually the topic of next week. That very
aren't you glad
question.
I segued for you?
Yes. You know, because it is really, I mean, it's like whatever is here, that needs to be met. And yes, you're right that we can tend to have that belief. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people, you know, a whole bunch of this teaching does you know, create sometimes a belief that, oh, I'm a Buddhist, I'm not supposed to be angry. And, you know, if anger is arising, we have to do our best to meet that with open-heartedness and compassion. Yep, absolutely. So thank you. And that is the subject for next week. So thank you all.